Good morning. Apologize, forgot to grab the mic before services started this morning. So you can go ahead and be turning your Bibles to Luke chapter 7. Luke chapter 7, we're going to spend most of our time there this morning. As you're turning, I'd like to welcome our visitors. We have a couple different visitors with us this morning. We're very grateful to have y'all. We have a good number of our regular members who are out this morning due to sickness or traveling. So we're grateful to have more faces here that we personally might not know as well, but we know that God knows you as he knows us. We're very grateful to have y'all worshiping with us this morning. So Luke chapter 7, we're going to look at the entirety of this chapter this morning. There are several different scenes that take place within this chapter, several different interactions that Jesus has with different people. We get a couple of miracles that are performed. We have a discussion between Jesus and the disciples of John the Baptist, and then we close with an interaction that Jesus has with the Pharisee and a sinful woman in the town there. As we read through this text together, as we study this, I hope that we're going to learn some things about the identity of Jesus, of who he is, and of how we should view ourselves in comparison to him and what he can do for us, what he wants to do for us. So let's go ahead and jump right into the text. Let's begin in Luke chapter 7 and verse 1. We'll read the first 10 verses here to begin. Luke chapter 7, beginning in verse 1. When he had completed all his words in the hearing of the people, he went to Capernaum. And a centurion's slave, who was highly regarded by him, was sick and about to die. Now when he heard about Jesus, he sent some Jewish elders asking him to come and save the life of his slave. And when they came to Jesus, they were earnestly pleading with him, saying, "He is worthy for you to grant this to him, for he loves our nation, and it was he who built us our synagogue." Now Jesus was going on his way with them, and when he was not far from the house, the centurion sent friends, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not good enough for you to come under my roof. For this reason, I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you, but just say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I also am a man placed under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to this one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my slave, 'Do this,' and he does it." Now when Jesus heard this, he marveled at him. And he turned to the crowd that was following him and said, "I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such great faith." And when those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave in good health. So let's just discuss for a moment just the setup of this the situation that takes place. Jesus is in Capernaum, and there's a centurion, and he has a slave who is sick, and this centurion sends the Jewish elders of the town where he lives to Jesus to ask Jesus to come and heal his slave. The centurion has obviously heard of Jesus. He's heard of some of the things that Jesus is able to do. And he seems to be in the good graces of the Jews in the town where he lives. And this would not have been a normal thing for a centurion to be on good terms with the Jews. The centurion being a Roman soldier, a Roman officer in command of a certain number of troops. The Jews generally were not fans of the Romans and their occupation, but this centurion is in favor with the Jews here. He seems to be someone who is, we're told that he loves their nation. He built their synagogue. He is favorably disposed to God's people. We don't have much more about him than that, but he's favorably disposed toward God's people. And so these Jews, he asked them to go and ask Jesus to come to him and heal his slave who is highly regarded by him. So the Jews go. They highly regard this man. They go to Jesus and they ask him, please come, you know, this centurion, please come and heal his servant. What reasons do they give? How do they try and get Jesus to come and to heal the man's slave? What do they say about the centurion? Well, it's interesting. It says they were earnestly pleading with Jesus, so they truly want him to come and help. But they say to Jesus about the centurion, "He is worthy for you to grant this to him. He is worthy of you doing this thing for him, of you coming and you healing his servant. He's worthy of that." And they give the reasons why they deem him worthy, because he loves our nation, because he built our synagogue for us. They say, because he's done these things for us, he is worthy for you to come and do this thing for him. That's how the Jews kind of couch their argument as to why Jesus needs to come and heal this man's slave. So Jesus goes along with them. He says what he's going on his way with them in verse 6. And he's not far from the house, but the centurion sends some more people. He sends some friends out to meet Jesus. And what the centurion says is very telling. The centurion says there in verse 6, "Lord, do not trouble yourself further, for I am not good enough for you to come under my roof. For this reason, I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you." What did the Jews just said? The Jews just said, oh, he's worthy for you to do this thing for him. He's done these things for us. He's worthy for you to come and grant him this wonderful gift of healing for his slave. Oh, he's worthy for you to come do this. But the centurion, that's not the mindset that he himself has. He recognizes, he says, I'm not good enough for you to even come under my roof. I'm not worthy for you to come to my house. I didn't even consider myself worthy to go to you myself and speak to you. So please don't even come, just say the word, and I know that my servant will be healed. Look at Jesus' response to this here. Look at his response to what the centurion says by the second group of people that he sends. When Jesus heard this, he marveled at him. It's not said a whole lot throughout the Gospels that Jesus marveled at somebody. And especially that he's marveling at him for a positive reason. Jesus marvels at this man. He is taken aback in some ways by the faith that this man is demonstrating, by what he said when he sent that second group of people. So Jesus marvels at him when he hears this. He commends the centurion's faith. He says, "I say to you, not even in Israel have I found such great faith." So remember, a centurion, a Roman officer. Jesus says, in all of Israel, in God's covenant people, I have not seen faith like this centurion is demonstrating when he says that I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof. I wasn't even worthy to appear to you and speak to you in person, but just say the word, I know that you can heal my servant. Jesus commends this man's faith here. It says, not even in Israel have I seen such faith. And I just think that if Jesus is marveling at someone's faith, if Jesus is commending someone's faith, we would probably do well to pause and study that man and his faith and just try and glean some things from that. If this is something that Jesus is marveling at, what is it about this man's faith that stands out? I think first off is he has a recognition of who he is. And we've already touched on some. He has a recognition of who he is, especially in relationship to Jesus. He is not worthy. He is not worthy to have Jesus do this thing for him. He recognizes who he is, but he also recognizes who Jesus is. He recognizes that Jesus is one who is an authority above him. He recognizes the authority that Jesus has. He recognizes that, and he recognizes the power that Jesus has to save. He recognizes the power that Jesus has to save, and so he knows that he needs that power. He knows that he needs that salvation, specifically for his servant here, for his slave. He knows that there's nothing else that can be done for his slave except perhaps Jesus would show mercy and heal him. And so he sins. He knows he's not worthy to have Jesus come, but he sins and he begs Jesus to have mercy on his slave, to grant that salvation, to heal his slave, grant that healing to his slave. He appeals to Jesus in faith. He appeals to Jesus in this faith, in this wonderful faith. And Jesus marvels at that, and Jesus heals the slave. Jesus grants the healing that the man is so desperately begging for, though he knows he's not worthy for Jesus to come and do that. This story, I think, really sets up what we're going to see throughout the rest of this chapter. We're going to look and we're going to study the who Jesus is and how others should and how everyone else should view themselves in comparison to Jesus and who he is and the authority and power that he possesses. Let's continue reading together in Luke chapter 7 and verse 11 through 17. And it happened that soon afterwards he went to a city called Nain, and his disciples were going along with him, accompanied by a large crowd. Now as he approached the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a sizable crowd from the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he felt compassion for her and said to her, "Do not cry." And he came up and touched the coffin, and the bearers came to a halt. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And the dead man sat up and began to speak. And Jesus gave him back to his mother. And fear gripped them all, and they began glorifying God, saying, "A great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited his people." And this report concerning him went out all over Judea and in all the surrounding district. So what's the setup for this scene that we have described for us here? Well, this is soon after Jesus has healed the centurion's slave. He's traveling to a city called Nain. And we're told that his disciples are with him, accompanied with a large crowd. So this is a large group of people that's traveling with Jesus to the city called Nain. And he's approaching the gate of the city, so approaching the entrance to the city, and out comes this funeral procession. And so we're told that this is a funeral, the outcomes of this funeral procession. This is a sizable crowd, we're told at the end of verse 12. So you have Jesus and his disciples and a large crowd that's following him. And then you have this large crowd that's exiting the city. There's these two large masses of humanity that are about to collide with each other right here at the gates of the city. And so as these crowds are coming together, we're told that we're told some more specifics about this funeral procession, that the man who has died, this is a young man who has died, he's the only son of his mother, and she's a widow. And just reading that in our modern context, that's a horribly sad situation to read of. Someone who's a widow, they only have one son, and that child precedes them in death. But this situation would have been even more heightened And here in the first century. You think about someone who is a widow, she would not have had means to care for herself. She doesn't have a husband who's providing for her. Her provision, the one who is supposed to take care of her, would have been her son, and he's just died. And so not only do you have the sorrow that's wrapped up in a parent losing their child and a widow losing her only family member, but she is now facing destitution. She's not going to have a means to care for herself. And so this is the scene that we have, and as Jesus comes up on this funeral procession, he sees the widow, he sees the mother, and what are we told about his reaction? We're told that he felt compassion for her. Jesus felt compassion for this woman. And he said to her, "Do not cry. Do not cry." And if anyone except for Jesus the Christ were to say that to a widow who has just lost her only son, that could be just like the most insensitive thing that you could possibly say. But Jesus, full of compassion, says, "Do not cry. Do not cry." Because he knows what he can do for her. He knows what he wants to do for her, what he's about to do for her. And so he comes up and he touches the coffin. He touches the coffin there. We're told the bearers come to a halt. He touches the coffin and he says, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And the dead man sat up and began to speak. And remember, we've got these two large crowds who are standing here watching all this, observing all this. You have this guy coming out on this funeral bier, not necessarily a coffin like we would think of with the lid shut or anything, but they're just carrying him out on this, think of it like a stretcher type of thing. Jesus touches him. And first off, that everyone would have like gasped at that point. You know, you think about the laws for cleanliness within the Old Testament. A dead human body is like the definition of unclean. So much so that anything that body touches, like this stretcher, it also would have been considered unclean. But Jesus reaches out and he touches the stretcher. He touches the death, the uncleanness, and he says, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And this guy, he like pops up. He pops up on the stretcher, and if everyone had been taken aback by Jesus reaching out and touching the unclean coffin, the unclean stretcher, they're even more taken aback as the dead man just sits up and he starts talking. He sits up and he begins speaking. And Jesus, he gave him back to his mother, the one that he had compassion for, and fear grips them all, and they begin glorifying God because of what they see here. So what do we learn here about the identity of Jesus? What does the story tell us about the identity of Jesus? Well, we read of his compassion. We read of the compassion that he has for his creation that's hurting, that is so poignantly enduring the effects of sin in this world. This woman, she's already lost her husband to death. Now she loses her only son to death. And Jesus, he sees that. He knows that. He feels that. He understands that. And he has compassion on this woman. I want us to note that. I want us to note the compassion that our God feels for us. The emotions that he felt while he was walking this earth. We see an example of that here, that he has compassion for this woman. And I think anyone here would have compassion for someone in that situation if we were to come up on that funeral procession. He has compassion for her, but then he acts on her behalf. He acts on that compassion for her. He raises her son from the dead. He touches the unclean thing, and he himself does not become unclean. And we see this in other passages where he reaches out and will touch a leprous person and cleanse them. Jesus himself does not become unclean because he is the one who can grant the cleansing. This guy is not unclean anymore. This young man is not unclean anymore. This stretcher is not unclean anymore because he's not dead. The source of the uncleanness is no longer there because Jesus has brought him back to life and granted that healing. And finally, I think we see about Jesus here, we see the authority that he has over even death. We saw the authority over sickness and disease with the centurion slave. Now we see Jesus has authority even over death. And he demonstrates that here as he acts on behalf of the woman whom he has compassion on. Let's read the next section together. This is a longer section, verses 18 through 35. And the disciples of John reported to him about all these things. Summoning two of his disciples, John sent them to the Lord, saying, "Are you the one who is to come, or should we look for someone else?" When the men came to him, they said, "John the Baptist has sent us to you, saying, 'Are you the one who is to come, or should we look for someone else?'" At that very time, he cured many people of diseases and afflictions and evil spirits, and he granted sight to many who were blind. And he answered and said to them, "Go and report to John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, the poor have the gospel preached to them. Blessed is he who does not take offense at me." And when the messengers of John had left, he began to speak to the crowds about John. "What did you go out into the wilderness to behold? A reed shaken by the wind? But what did you go out to see? A man dressed in soft garments? Behold, those who are splendidly clothed and live in luxury are found in royal palaces. But what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I say to you, and even more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, 'Behold, I send my messenger ahead of you, who will prepare your way before you.' I say to you, among those born of women, there is no one greater than John. Yet he who is least in the kingdom of God is greater than he." And when all the people and the tax collectors heard this, they acknowledged God's justice, having been baptized with the baptism of John. But the Pharisees and the scholars of the law rejected God's purpose for themselves, not having been baptized by John. "To what then shall I compare the men of this generation? And what are they like? They are like children sitting in the marketplace and calling to one another, who say, 'We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We sang a dirge, and you did not cry.' For John the Baptist has come eating no bread and drinking no wine, and you say, 'He has a demon.' The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, 'Behold, a gluttonous man and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.' Yet wisdom is vindicated by all her children." Wisdom is vindicated by all her children. So we have these disciples of John the Baptist who are sent to Jesus. Why does John the Baptist send these disciples? Why doesn't he just come to Jesus himself? Well, a few chapters earlier, at the end of or middle of Luke 3, we're told that John is proclaiming the gospel. He's preaching against Herod, the king of the region, And Herod, Luke chapter 3 and verse 20, Herod also added this to them, all the wicked things that he's done. He locked John up in prison. So at this point in time, John the Baptist is locked up in prison. And so he sends some of his disciples to Jesus. And he has a question. He has a question that he asks. And he says, are you the one who is to come? Or should we look for someone else? And this is a question that in so many words you see asked of Jesus sometimes throughout the scripture, throughout the Gospels. Is he the Messiah? Who is this? But for John the Baptist to ask this question is jarring. Because what has he been doing? Why is he locked up in prison? Well, because he's been proclaiming that Jesus is the one. Jesus is the Messiah. He's preparing the way for the Lord. But now, at this point in time, he's questioning. Are you really the one? Are you the one that we look for, or should we be looking for somebody else? Why do you think that he asked this question? Now, obviously, he's locked up in prison, right? I'm quite sure, feeling discouraged at this point. Things might not have gone how he quite envisioned them going. Perhaps is his faith faltering here as he questions to some degree the identity of Jesus. But I want us to look at Jesus' response here. So the disciples come, they ask the question of Jesus. Verse 21, at that very time, he cured many people of diseases and afflictions and evil spirits, and he granted sight to many who were blind. And he answered and said to them, go and report to John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. The dead are raised up, the poor have the gospel preached to them. Blessed is he who does not take offense at me. So at that very time, Jesus does all of these wondrous miracles. And then after he does them, he turns to the disciples of John the Baptist and says, go tell John what you just saw and what you just heard. And tell him, and in telling them that, he quotes from the book of Isaiah. He quotes from Isaiah 35 and from Isaiah 61. We'll turn and read those passages here in just a moment. But he quotes there from Isaiah. And as he quotes from Isaiah, the point that he's making here to John the Baptist's disciples, he's not just doing all these miracles, just doing a huge miracle show so that he can then send to John and basically be like, come on, John. Who else could do these things? That's not what Jesus is doing here. He performs these miracles. He performs these specific miracles. Remember, we just saw the afflicted being healed there at the beginning of chapter 7. We just saw the dead being raised with the widow's sons. Right at this very time, we see many people of diseases and afflictions being healed, granting sight to those who are blind. He's performing these specific miracles to point back to these specific passages in Isaiah and show and demonstrate their fulfillment. So let's look at Isaiah 35 together. Flip back in your Old Testaments, if you will, to Isaiah 35. It was mentioned in Bible class this morning talking about how the need to read the Old Testament, to study the Old Testament, and to, from the Old Testament, learn about God, learn about who he is, learn about Jesus, how the Old Testament scriptures point to Jesus, and learn about Jesus, learn about God and their nature from the Old Testament passages. So Isaiah 35, beginning in verse 3. Strengthen limp hands and give courage to the knees of the stumbling. Say to those with an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come, but he will save you. Then the eyes of the blind will be opened, and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. Then the lame will leap like a deer, and the tongues of the mute will shout for joy, for waters will break forth in the wilderness, and streams in the Arabah. Then the scorched land will become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water, and the haunt of jackals its resting place. Grass becomes reeds and rushes. And a roadway will be there, a highway, and it will be called the Highway of Holiness. The unclean will not pass by on it, but it will be for him who walks in that way, and ignorant fools will not walk on it. No lion will be there, nor will any vicious beast go up on it. These will not be found there, but the redeemed will walk there. And the ransomed of Yahweh will return, and come with joyful shouting to Zion, and everlasting gladness upon their heads. They will attain delight and gladness, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. So Jesus quotes specifically really from verse 5 there, Isaiah 35 and verse 5, then the eyes of the blind will be opened and the ears of the deaf will be unstopped. But as is more often than not the case in the New Testament, when someone in the New Testament, whether it's Jesus or a writer of an epistle or something later on, quotes from the Old Testament, they're not just pulling a random verse out of context to use it because it suits their purposes there. They're quoting the verse to call attention to everything going on in the context of that original verse. So what's going on in the context of Isaiah 35 and verse 5? Well, there's just this general healing and restoration that is being granted. We see those who are anxious of heart being told to be strong, to not fear, that God will come with vengeance. The recompense of God will come, but he will save you in verse 4. We see the hope that is being given to these people who are struggling, to these people who are afflicted. Turn now to Isaiah 61, the other passage that Jesus quotes from in Luke 7. Isaiah 61, we'll read the first three verses together. Isaiah 61, beginning in verse 1. The Spirit of Lord Yahweh is upon me, because Yahweh has anointed me to bring good news to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim release to captives and freedom to prisoners, to proclaim the favorable year of Yahweh and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant those who mourn in Zion, giving them a headdress instead of ashes, the oil of rejoicing instead of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of a spirit of fainting. So they will be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of Yahweh, that he may show forth his beautiful glory. And so we see there in Isaiah 61, we see in verse 1 specifically, we see the quotation that Jesus quotes there in Luke chapter 7 and verse 22, the idea of the afflicted having the good news being brought to them, the idea of the poor having the gospel preached to them. It's the same verse that's being quoted there. But again, what else is going on in the context of Isaiah 61? Not only are the afflicted hearing the good news, but the brokenhearted are being bound up. The captives are having release proclaimed to them, freedom to the prisoners. Do you think that would resonate with John the Baptist as he's there sitting, languishing in Herod's prison, questioning, was Jesus really the one? Was all of that for nothing? Jesus compassionately points him back to the Old Testament prophecies which he would have known and saying, no, I'm the one. I'm the one, and this is what I'm bringing about. Comfort to those who mourn. Freedom for the captives. And we read throughout the rest of the Gospels, no, John the Baptist is not going to be freed from Herod's prison physically. He's going to be killed by Herod. He's going to be beheaded. But there was freedom in the kingdom that he was proclaiming. And so Jesus, in his response here, he performs all of these different miracles, again, not just to do a bunch of cool things to then, hey, go tell John all the signs that I'm doing. He does these specific miracles. He tells the disciples of John to go tell John what Isaiah said in Isaiah 35. Go tell John what Isaiah prophesied in Isaiah 61 and how it's being fulfilled right now. So that John should take heart from the message of Isaiah. So that he should be strengthened even in his distress, knowing that the Messiah has come, the kingdom is coming, and God is accomplishing what he has set out to accomplish. And Jesus tells him there at the end, and blessed is he who does not take offense at me. Blessed is he who does not take offense at me. And I don't read this as an incredibly harsh criticism of John, but just as something like, just as a reminder, listen, don't take offense at me. I know things are not going as maybe you thought that they would be going, but if you don't take offense at me, you will be blessed. Blessed is he who does not take offense at me. And so the disciples of John, they go off to give John that message. The message that John himself, he has not forgotten. That the kingdom that he proclaimed, in fact, is coming about. And that though John is mourning right now, he will be planted as an oak of righteousness, as Isaiah prophesied in Isaiah 61. And Jesus then turns and is speaking to the rest of the crowds who are there. He's speaking to the crowds, and he asks them a series of rhetorical questions. He asks them these questions, he says, what did you go out in the wilderness to see? a reed shaken by the wind? Well, what did you go out to see? Did you go out to see a man who's dressed in all these nice clothes? You know, he said, no, you didn't do that. You don't go out into the wilderness to see people who are dressed up nice. You go to palaces to see that. Everybody's seen a reed shaken by the wind, something that's not accomplishing anything. You didn't go out there to see something that wasn't accomplishing anything. But what did you go out to see? And these rhetorical questions that he's asking them are leading to this answer. If you went out to see a prophet, and you went out to see someone who is more than simply a prophet, you went out to see the prophet, the messenger. And let me tell you about John the Baptist, the one who's currently sitting in Herod's prison, who's struggling with some of this. He says, there is none born of woman greater than John the Baptist. John is great, is what Jesus is saying here. His message was great. He was the one that he was the forerunner that the Old Testament prophets were pointing to. John is a great man, is what Jesus tells the crowds here. But even more than that is that those who accept John's message are even greater. Those who accept the kingdom that John is proclaiming are even greater. And so you look here and you see, so who are the ones who have accepted John's message? Who are the ones who have accepted the kingdom? Well, verse 29, when all the people and the tax collectors heard this, they acknowledged God's justice, having been baptized with the baptism of John. The people, some of the masses, the tax collectors, those who were sinners, those who were cast out because of their sin and taking advantage of people, they had accepted John's message. They had been baptized with his baptism, preparing the way of the kingdom that was coming. They recognized their need for forgiveness. They recognized that need, and so they submitted to that call. But who didn't do that? Who did not do that? Well, it's the Pharisees and the leaders, the scholars of the law, who rejected, we're told, God's purpose for themselves. And it's because they did not see the need. Oh, they were studied in the Old Testament scriptures. They knew the law. They were the ones who taught the law. But in doing that, they had missed the message of the law. They had missed the spirit behind all of that. And they had missed the messenger. They had missed the one the messenger was proclaiming, the kingdom that was coming. They missed it. They not just missed it, they had rejected it for themselves. And Jesus rebukes them here in this little parable, verses 31 through 35. He compares them to these children who are sitting in the marketplace calling out, hey, we played the flute for you. We played a very upbeat, happy song for you, and you didn't dance along to it. We sang a dirge and you didn't cry. You know, we did all of these things. We came and presented ourselves in a happy manner with this happy song played on the flute. We presented ourselves in a sad manner, singing a funeral dirge. You didn't want any of it. You didn't want any of it. And comparing the Pharisees and the rulers and all those who had rejected John's message, saying, you know, John came and he was out there in the wilderness and he looked different. He's wearing camel's hair, he's eating locusts, he's eating wild honey, all those things, fulfillments of Old Testament prophecy. But you didn't want that. You didn't want that. You thought he was a madman. You thought he had a demon. And then the Son of Man comes, the one whom John was proclaiming, the Son of Man comes and he's eating and drinking like normal. And you say, oh, he's just a glutton. He's a friend of tax collectors and sinners. So he's like, what did you want the Messiah to look like? What did you want the kingdom to look like? Because you've been rejecting it at every turn. They are refusing to acknowledge who John was, even though it was obvious. And they are refusing to acknowledge who Jesus is, even though it's obvious as well. He's just perfectly fulfilling passages like Isaiah 35, like Isaiah 61, all of these passages, but they're refusing to acknowledge it. They're rejecting God's purpose for themselves. That leads us to the final scene that we have here in Luke chapter 7, beginning in verse 36. Let's read together verse 36 through the end of the chapter. Now one of the Pharisees was asking him to eat with him, and he entered the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. And behold, there was a woman in the city who was a sinner. And when she learned that he was reclining at the table in the Pharisee's house, she brought an alabaster jar of perfume. And standing behind him at his feet, crying, she began to wet his feet with her tears. And she kept wiping them with the hair of her head and kissing his feet and anointing them with the perfume. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, saying, If this man were a prophet, he would know who and what sort of person this woman is who is touching him, that she is a sinner. And Jesus answered and said to him, Simon, I have something to say to you. And he said, Say it, teacher. A moneylender had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. When they were unable to repay, he graciously forgave them both. So which of them will love him more? Simon answered and said, I suppose the one whom he graciously forgave more. And he said to him, You have judged correctly. And turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but she, since the time I came in, has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with perfume. For this reason I say to you, her sins, which are many, have been forgiven, for she loved much. But he who is forgiven little loves little. Then he said to her, Your sins have been forgiven. And those who were reclining at the table with him began to say to themselves, Who is this man who even forgives sins? And he said to the woman, Your faith has saved you. Go in peace. So we see here playing out before us on the text just the perfect example of what Jesus described earlier in verses 29 and 30, where the tax collectors and the people acknowledged God's justice and accepted the kingdom, but the Pharisees and the scholars rejected it. We see that playing out here as this woman comes to Jesus in the house of a Pharisee. And this woman is a known sinner, we're told. She's a known sinner in this community, but she comes to Jesus. She learns that he's there, and she comes to him seeking forgiveness. And like the centurion at the beginning of the chapter, she recognizes her unworthiness before Jesus. She recognizes that she is not worthy to even look at him necessarily. She is not worthy of what Jesus has to offer, but she comes seeking him anyways. And this is contrasted with this Pharisee, whom we're told is named Simon, midway through the story. It's contrasted with Simon here, the Pharisee, who comes across, he's very judgmental of this woman. He's very self-righteous in who he is and how he keeps the law and what he knows. And Jesus tells this parable to highlight Simon's attitude. This parable of the two debtors, one owed 500 denarii. You know, that's, you know, 500 denarii, that's a lot of money. That's well over a year's wages, going on at least 2 years' wages. But and then you have this other who owes 50 denarii, maybe 2 months' wages or so. And so Jesus said, hey, these two guys owe these different amounts of money. They are both forgiven. Which one's going to love the moneylender more, the one who offered them forgiveness more? And Simon's, it's an obvious question. It's like, well, the one who was forgiven more, the man who owed the 500 denarii. Jesus, that's correct. You've answered correctly. And then he turns to the woman, the sinner, the known sinner, and he tells Simon, you know, she has been washing my feet with her tears ever since I came in here. You didn't even offer me water to wash my feet, something that would have been a common thing to offer a guest in your home. So you didn't even offer me that. But she has not ceased to wet my feet with her tears and to wipe them with her hair. You didn't offer me a kiss when I came in, a greeting that one might offer a guest in home. You didn't offer me that. She has not ceased to kiss my feet since she has been here. She recognized who she was. She recognized who Jesus was. And she approaches him humbly, penitently, begging for mercy. Simon did not recognize who Simon was. Simon had this view of himself that was incorrect. Simon definitely did not recognize who Jesus was. And so Simon does not approach Jesus as he should have. Simon does not approach him recognizing his own unworthiness, recognizing the authority and the power that Jesus has to act on his behalf. And so we're told Jesus forgives the sins of the woman here. He says, your sins have been forgiven. And what does he tell her? He says, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Just like the centurion, this woman approaches Jesus in faith and receives the mercy, the healing, the forgiveness that she is looking for. As we've been reading through this and talking through this morning, I hope that we've been seeing the lessons that we need to grab from this. We've been seeing the application for ourselves. recognizing that to come to Jesus in the first place, to come to Jesus, I must have a recognition of my own unworthiness, of my own inability to do anything for myself. I have to recognize that. But not only do I have to recognize my own unworthiness to come to Jesus, I must have a recognition of Jesus' power and of His authority and of His desire to save. That's what the centurion recognized. He knew the power of Jesus. He knew the authority that Jesus possessed. And so he approaches Jesus. He approaches Jesus, recognizes his own unworthiness, begging Jesus to come and heal him, the same thing that the woman does here at the end of the chapter. Recognizing that there's no hope anywhere else. There's no hope from any other. There's no hope in my own righteousness. There's only hope in Jesus the Christ. And approaching humbly with that recognition. But then after that, to stay with Jesus after he has granted that healing and that salvation, to stay with Jesus, I'm going to submit to you today that I must remember those first two things. In order to stay with him, I must remember who I was when I came to him. I must remember my own unworthiness. And I must remember his compassion that he showed me. His compassion that he showed me as he executed his authority to save me, the power to save me. I have to remember those two things as I continue walking with him. Remembrance of my broken, helpless state. Remembrance that my right relationship with God, my right standing before God is based purely on his grace and on his mercy. It's not that he did his part and then I did my part. It's that he saved me. That he in his compassion touched me and said, "Young man, arise." And remembering these things, it drives away any self-righteousness that I might be tempted to have. It drives away any judgmentalism that I might be tempted to have as I'm interacting with others who desperately need that healing. Remembering these things helps me see where I still fall short at times and where I must grow to better imitate God, to better display the character of his son that was demonstrated for me in his life here. So the question that I ask you this morning is, do you recognize these things about yourself? Do you recognize your unworthiness? Do you recognize the power that Jesus has to save? Do you recognize the authority that Jesus has to save? Do you recognize the desire that Jesus has to save you? If you've already submitted in baptism to that call, let's remember these things. Let's remember where we have come from, the broken state that we are in, as we humbly approach God, begging, appealing for a clean conscience. Let's recognize the wondrous healing that has been granted to us. And let's let these things drive us forward as he works to perfect us and to make us into the people that he created us to be in the first place. Let's remember these things and grow and have a desire to share these things with those around us who are broken as well. So if there's anything that we can do for you this morning to help you, to encourage you in your walk, to help you get started on your walk, we would love to do that. We would love to share the love and compassion that Jesus has shared with us. So if there's anything we can do for you, I ask that you would let us know this morning. You can come forward now as we stand and as we sing.